You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon outside Washington. Almost 3,000 people died that day in what was the worst terrorist attack on American soil. The one terror plot that was foiled ended near Shanksville in Somerset County here in Pennsylvania. The passengers of United Flight 93 stormed the hijacked plane's cabin, and in the struggle, the plane crashed into a field, killing everyone aboard. The passengers of Flight 93 are often called the first heroes of the War on Terror. A Smart Talk road trip today takes us to the spot just a few hundred yards from where the plane crashed at the Flight 93 Memorial. Over the next hour, we'll go back to that day and hear from a family member of one of the passengers and young people who have grown up with 9/11 in the background. But up front, we're joined by Stephen Clark, superintendent of national parks in western Pennsylvania, which includes the Flight 93 Memorial. Superintendent Clark, thank you for being with us today. This is a special place. I just want to say that right off the bat, that anyone, when they visit the Flight 93 Memorial, look out onto that field, they know it is a special place. Talk about that, if you would.
Scott, first off, it truly is a pleasure and an honor to be with you and your audience today. I'd have to say, in my 35 years with the National Park Service and having had the honor of serving as the superintendent here at Flight 93 the last 6 years, there's no question that when you come off of Route 30 into this incredible special 2,200-acre world-class memorial, it takes you to a place most people don't expect. They're not really sure what they're going to see, what they're going to experience. But through our incredible ambassadors and our park rangers and our staff, we pride ourselves to making sure that everyone who comes here, whether it's for an hour, 5 hours, whatever it may be, truly embraces the uniqueness of this story and those 40 individuals on that airplane who truly changed the world forever. And I think that's what makes this memorial, Flight 93 National Memorial in Somerset County, Pennsylvania, such a special and unique place.
One of the things that I've always noticed, and I've been here several times, is that it's a place of reverence. The people who visit here realize that it not only is a special place, but a place of reverence.
It truly is. And when you look back at the design of this memorial, and this was created by Paul Murdoch and his team, just through his brilliance, he divided the 2,200 acres up into three phases, if you would, three areas. Currently, we are now within the Learning Center and the Visitor Center complex, dedicated in September of 2015. And then in 2018, we dedicated the Tower of Voices, which we like to refer to as the Welcoming Beacon, a 93-foot high tower, concrete structure with containing 40 wind chimes, again, representing the 40. But I would say that in 2011 was the most unique and most special of them all, because in essence, it opened the world to the Wall of Names, which is directly adjacent to what we call the sacred ground, the exact location of the impact of that airplane on September 11th at 10:03 and 11 seconds, to be exact. And, you know, that's where, individuals, they took their last breath doing what they could to try and thwart that attack. And that's exactly what happened. So, yes, it's a very somber place. And again, Scott, as you alluded to, down by the Wall of Names, there is silence. There is an incredible sense of just commitment and understanding what they did for this great nation and ultimately for the world.
Let's go back to that day. It's been 20 years. Let's go back to September 11th, 2001, and what happened over the skies of where we sit right now.
So I was a ranger in the U.S. Virgin Islands at the time, and I distinctly recall being notified that there had been an aircraft crashing into one of the World Trade Center towers. And even at that point in the Caribbean, we knew something was not normal, that something was wrong. And if you really take a moment to analyze the timeline, and that's so important, on September 11th, the first plane at 8:46 crashing into the tower. Was it some type of a medical emergency with the pilot? Nobody really knew. At 9:03, when another aircraft hit the second tower, this was no accident. And so at that point, Flight 93 was continuing to travel across Pennsylvania into the Cleveland airspace, into Ohio. And then at 9:28, the plane was hijacked by four individuals, all seated in first class. And then you take the fact that at 9:28, the hijackers took control of the aircraft. At 9:37, American Airlines Flight 77 impacted the Pentagon. Now, at that moment, the individuals, the heroes on that plane had been directed by the pilot and others to go to the back of the plane. And that's why this story unfolds so specially for the last 20, 30 minutes, because in real time, they started to understand through phone calls. 13 people made a total of 37 phone calls. They knew about what happened in New York. They knew they had been hijacked. They were a part of something. But when 77 hit the Pentagon, they said, we're not going back to any airport. And that's when they literally took a vote. The most profound and American democratic thing we have the privilege of, voting. And they took a vote to try and do something. Flight attendants boiling water to place in stainless steel pitchers. Other individuals using cushions. They knew they were going to go up through that 757 center aisle to try and do something to get that airplane back. And so at 9:57, you hear the story of Todd Beamer talking to Lisa Jefferson, an airphones operator in Chicago, and we're getting ready to do something. Todd, don't hang up the phone. He said, I won't. Tell my wife I love her. All those type of things. But every single person on that plane, all 40, the 33 passengers, the five flight attendants, and the two pilots, we always talk about them as one. So at 9:57, they did make that courageous journey up through that center aisle, and they did reach the cockpit door. There's no question about that. How do we know? Because of the cockpit voice recorder. Because we heard in Arabic, should we put it down? No, wait till they all come. But then in English, into the cockpit or we die. And frankly, Scott, they ran out of time. Because the terrorist pilot knew they were trying to get in through that cockpit door, and he started to push the plane left and right, steer to try to put him off balance, and then a series of porpoising maneuvers, again, to try to put him off balance. And then, frankly, at the very, very end, about 10:02, 30 seconds or so, the terrorist pilot pushes it to the right, and it inverts. It goes virtually upside down. It loses its lift, and that's what created, at that point, the crash at the site that we are in right now, a mere 18 minutes flying time from Washington, D.C. It's most likely target the U.S. Capitol building. 4,500 employees, countless thousands of visitors in and around, not to mention men and women of both the Senate and the House. That's why the story of Flight 93 is so special. And I believe it will go down in history as one of the bravest acts of heroism and courage by civilians, not Navy SEALs, not Army Rangers, but people just like you and I, who faced with unbelievable circumstances, did the right thing and acted. And that's why I believe people continue to come here. We're continually in the 400,000 range. And as you can attest, you have to want to come here. It's not a place you can, oh, there it is. And the journey that people are making from all over the world is what makes, again, this place such a special, special place.
One of the unique aspects of this, as you mentioned, is that the passengers had an opportunity to make those phone calls. Is there any one or several that stick out to you? You mentioned the Todd Beamer call, but are there any of those phone calls that really jump out at you?
Well, of those 37, sir, four of them were recorded. And of those four, remember back in 2001, you go in the kitchen, you have the little blinking right. red light. Mm-hmm. So of those four, you know, we're able to play and visitors are able to listen to three of those calls inside the visitor center. And they just, the strength of these individuals really, really, it just takes your breath away with the courage of CeCe Lyles and these calls that are just letting their loved ones know something happened on the plane. And again, it just instills an unbelievable amount of pride as Americans and those around the world of what these people were faced with. So of those, again, 37, four were recorded, but a lot of them spoke to family members and 911 operators and so forth. But I would say collectively, they're all important, and I wouldn't put one over any other.
You know, that's something else that sticks out about those phone calls. Okay, the four you mentioned that are recorded, but when we heard from the family members afterwards, is that there didn't seem to be a lot of panic. Mm-hmm. There was excitement, but this seemed like you were hearing from people on a mission.
Yeah.
I mean, you had people who were telling their loved ones, I love you, you know, you're the greatest thing in my life, that kind of thing. But you also heard in their voices that they weren't giving up, that they were on a mission, and whether they were confident that it was going to work or not or be successful, we don't know. But there didn't seem to be panic.
No. And you, that's evidenced by these phone calls. You know, in fact, at one point, and someone is talking about the combination for a safe, you know, and there's no screaming and it's emotion. It's, you know, there's trouble on the plane, you know, that type of a calmness, which is remarkable in light of what they had experienced. And so again, you think about it, can you have done that? Could we have done that if you were in that position? Again, you like to think so, but you don't know. And the other thing about 93 in this story is that it has inspired and thwarted other incidents and other attacks, even in Europe, where people are now saying, what would, you know, the 93, the courage to say, no, I'm not going to sit idly by and just sit here and let something happen catastrophic in nature. And again, I think that's another part of the story of the men and women aboard Flight 93 to inspire others down the road to step up, have the courage, and do the right thing.
It's been 20 years since Flight 93 crash. It has taken a while to for this memorial to come together. I remember being here 9 months after September 11th when there was nothing but a fence with mementos and flags and you parked on gravel. And now, as you said, it is a world-class memorial. Talk about the planning stages and how this all came together.
Well, it starts with the word community. It starts with the word harmony, and then it rolls into the incredible, powerful word of partnerships. Without the men and women and the people of Somerset County and Western Pennsylvania, and then across the nation, and yes, across the globe, the reason Flight 93 National Memorial is where it is today is because of all of those entities, those businesses, those people that stepped up in the middle of the darkness, in the middle of the night to try and make a difference, especially in the beginning. People coming here, our ambassadors who brought lasagna to state troopers and coffee in those first few days. Nobody really understood what was happening, but we knew that something was part of this terrorist plot. And so the families in the very beginning, they knew that this place had to be, you know, kind of interpreted and brought to others as a source of inspiration is what I'm trying to say, Scott. And that's exactly what happened. Your next guest, Pat White, and other family members were instrumental in working with the National Park Service, the Secretary of the Interior, just the federal government as a whole, to get us to where we needed to be to even make this place what it is today. So you have the Friends of Flight 93, our 501c3 partner, if you would, the National Park Foundation, almost $50 million in private funds, from $10 checks to $1 million donations from businesses. That's what it's all about. The harmony, the community, the partnerships that make this place what it is. And as I mentioned, I've been doing this a long time in the Park Service, but never have I witnessed and experienced, nor do I know of, a more special, unique partnership than with the National Park Foundation, the families, the National Park Service, and our family, the Friends group of Flight 93. So those elements are the reason this memorial is what it is today.
For someone who has never been here, how would you describe it to them physically?
It's a 2,200-acre oasis where, regardless of what's happening in the world or in your own life, you know you're coming here to experience something special. And as I mentioned, when you come in off of Route 30, we have our sign, we have our four colonies of honeybees, we have that pollinator garden 200 yards long. You just know you're in a special place. Then on the left, of course, as I mentioned, the Tower of Voices. It's a vast array of meadow and fields and forest and just trails and vistas that just take your breath away. And so when you go to the Tower of Voices or to the Visitor Center and then down to the Boulder area, you know, the Wall of Names, or you go to the Wall of Names first and then kind of in opposite order, reverse order. No matter where you go, you have somewhere else to look forward to. And again, our trail system here, our places of reflection for our benches, our wayside exhibits. And again, most importantly, it's who you meet when you're here, as well as encountering ambassadors and rangers and other volunteers who really are the backbone of our incredible story here at Flight 93.
There's a lot of symbolism.
There is.
For example, just one example, you can see when you drive into the parking lot, the path that the plane took that went to its final resting place. That you can see that long path down to the boulder, as you call it. There's a boulder that marks the spot where the plane actually crashed.
Right.
That people can't, the public can't walk on that. How was that decision made? Family members do go down to the boulder, but
they do.
That the public, a distance, you have to stay a distance away.
Yeah. You know, Scott, I would start off with the design competition that occurred many, many years ago when there were over 1,100 entries from 27 countries who were interested in the design of here. So together with community members and families and government officials, we were able to whittle that 1,100 down to 5. And then from those 5, ultimately Paul Murdoch's vision was selected. And Paul Murdoch is so committed and so brilliant that the way he created this memorial with the obscure symbolism to the Hemlock Grove or to the coal mining and so forth, very subtle. So when he created that flight path, which takes you to the flight path overlook, where you can see the preamble to our mission statement, a common field one day, a field of honor forever. And as you approach the first portal in the wall, he forces your eyes to go to the sliver of sky. And then as you go through the second portal, and then the boulder, the sacred ground, roughly a quarter of a mile away, comes into view. And then you read the preamble to our mission statement. It's that experience that Paul Murdoch truly treasures in his heart to create that experience for our visitors. And so when you are at the Overlook, you can look at the vast array of the wildflowers and the trees and the allay plantings, and of course down to the sacred ground. But then as you go personally, physically to the Wall of Names, true, you can get 50 yards, 100 yards or so from the boulder itself as you gaze out and wonder what happened on that particular morning. And that to me, as I mentioned, is the most special place of the memorial, that crash site.
Well, that mission statement, I have to admit that it's one that brings a lump to my throat, and I'm sure many other people's throats as well when they're standing there looking over that field.
It sure is.
Stephen Clark, Superintendent of National Parks in Western Pennsylvania. That includes the Flight 93 Memorial. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, again, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I was maybe 5 minutes away from my parents' house when my sister calls me and said that United just told my mom and dad around 6 o'clock at night that Joey was one of the passengers aboard Flight 93. And
did you believe it then?
You know, I believed on the way home. I mean, the way down, you get that feeling that the connection in your life is gone.
And that's Ken Nacky, brother of Joey Nacky, who was one of the passengers on Flight 93. Louis J. Nacky II, or Joey, as he was called by his family, was a passenger on Flight 93. His cousin Patrick White was very close with Joey Nacky and the rest of his family, and also closely involved with several groups that include families of Flight 93. Pat White is with us today. Pat, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, it's truly an honor to be here, not only as representative of our immediate family, but more so for all of the other family members who would not have the opportunity to be here today. Thank you for having us.
Well, let's talk about your cousin first.
Sure.
Joey. Tell me about Joey.
Joey was a force. He was truly an individual. Heart of gold, and a fellow who was very focused. He was very much like my other younger cousins. I'm the eldest on my mother's side of the family, very tight-knit. And so vacations spent together, holidays spent together, especially with my Aunt Phil, Uncle Paul, and their kids, Joey, Ken, Paula, and later Dale. So Joey, there's story after story about the kind of individual he was, shirt off his back kind of guy. The fact that he was on Flight 93 is a testimonial to his sense of commitment and doing something instead of asking someone else to do it. He could have certainly sent one of the other employees out to solve a problem on the West Coast, which is the reason he was on Flight 93 as a last-minute business trip. I think the thing that's probably most emblematic about Joey is at a very early age, wearing a Superman cape, he crashed through a plate glass sliding door, nearly lost his arm, 100-plus stitches, and yet he comes through it all to a place where he gets a Superman tattoo and becomes a guy who does weightlifting and just, like I said, was a force. I can remember instances aplenty about his good-natured smile, his embrace, and in our family, the males still traditionally kiss, and there was never a moment of shyness or embarrassment about any of that. He was as much a part of the fiber and fabric of our family as anyone, like myself, a firstborn male in his own immediate family.
So how did your family find out? We just heard from Joey's brother, Ken, when he found out about the Flight 93 crash. How did you find out about it, and what did you hear about his parents and the rest of the family?
Technology. same as the tools they use to know what to do. Phone call, 6:30, whatever-ish in the evening. And just the tragic news that, we'd lost, to me, very much a younger brother. And just absorbing the impact of all of that, of, how it was going to affect the others. And earlier in the day, unbeknownst to us, we all were, that he was on the plane, I'd said to my secretary in the office, because we had a chance to watch it on TV, when the news came through about Flight 93, I said, I don't know about anyone else, but as to my brothers and me, we would have stood up. We would have done something. And when we found out that, Joey was there and subsequently learned, his voice was on the cockpit voice recorder. His remains were located in an area where the cockpit of the plane, several hundred yards from the impact point, that's where his remains and wallet were found. We know where he was, and we know why he was there, because of who he is. And so we've done our best to heal and to try to be whole. My daughter got married about 6 weeks or so, just shortly a month after September 11th. And I remember her calling and saying to me, "Hey, Dad, with Joey passing and everything, we're thinking about calling off the wedding." I said, "Sweetheart, you can't do that. We need to be together. Everybody's made their plans. I know my cousin and our family well enough that it would be the last thing they want to do is not be together." And it was the last time my aunts, uncles, the entire, as many family members as could be there were together. And it was a celebration of love. We exhaled and inhaled and remembered that life was for living. Sadly, my Uncle Paul, Joey's dad, passed away shortly after. And we dealt with that double loss of two men in our family who were very much at the forefront of how we lived and the values we hold to be so close to the heart.
Thank you for opening up about that. I want to move to this memorial and memorializing the site where Joey died. How did you get involved? And you became very involved where you were the president of a couple of organizations that were instrumental in building this memorial and conveying the wishes of the family, families, I should say.
I'll start by saying, as Steve had said, it's a partnership. No one individual can be identified as having done, if you will, more or less than another. In one of those, two of those partner groups early on, especially, were the Federal Advisory Commission, and my cousin Ken was selected to be on that. And I also had interviewed, but it was more appropriate, obviously, that his Joey's brother be on it. But shortly after, he called and said, "Hey, I need your help." And I said, "Whatever. However long it takes, whatever you need." And that began this journey, both from the perspective of being a land use lawyer, is my profession, as well as being a family member, in understanding what was going to be needed here, both from the Flight 93 Memorial Act signed by President Bush in 2002 to, where we are today. I continue to have an active involvement through Park Service, through the Friends Group, in what are needed as either operational or maintenance aspects We are pretty much done. I always coined the phrase, there were the four Ds. There was the design. There was, you know, dirt for the land. There was dollars in order to be able to buy land, build it. And then the fourth D was done. We're all, you know, almost done. There are things that'll continue to be needed. And I will continue to be involved to the extent that I still believe that I'm being of service. So the request of my cousin first turned into being on a series of committees with the operational arm that was the counterpart to the Federal Advisory Commission, and that was the Flight 93 Memorial Task Force. I became one of the co-chairs along with a couple of other gentlemen, and we were the ones through that series of committees that did everything from fundraising to design work, working on the general management plan with Park Service, resource assessment. There were just so many aspects and facets to it. And as I said, I was a land use lawyer. I ultimately went over to the private sector and the law firm Porter Wright that I worked for, retired from. I probably have 30 plus banker's boxes full of files of materials that they're still holding on from me. Thousands and thousands of emails and meetings and just everything it takes that you can imagine to build a project like this, and to do it always with a sense of honoring those 40 heroes and being able to tell their collective story. So it's been a journey that's made me, I believe, not only a better lawyer, but as I've said before, I think a better person as well. And that's the best way I know how to honor my cousin, our family, and the other family members as well.
Almost finished. I'm going to use that term, almost finished. Mm-hmm. Now that you have stepped back somewhat from your roles in these organizations, I get the sense that you now have an opportunity to appreciate what the almost finished product looks like. Talk about that if you would.
Absolutely, that's correct. I had mentioned that at one point it was akin to being part of the production of a play and everything on stage that would go with the logistics and that whole creation of something. And then now being more one of the individuals who's in the audience and able to appreciate the totality of it, you know, kind of from a perspective that the more traditional, the typical visitor from anywhere on the planet when they come here. Certainly, we understood that we had to be able to be in those individuals' shoes as we designed and laid things out. But to actually be able to step back and experience it in a way that others do more routinely, it has been a blessing for me. I can offer you the example of last September 11th, having dedicated the last of the chimes for the tower a couple days before, my wife on my arm, walking through the gate, the ceremonial gate that's open only once a year on that day, and being the last one to walk out to the boulder, to the crash site. I just had a sense and a feeling that for once, my cousin's soul was something I could feel being let go in a very real sense, similar to how I felt like I was letting go of the responsibilities, the duty, the service. And as we walked out, it was just a remarkable type of an experience to have that. It felt like not so much a thank you or a reward or anything like that, but rather just a connection at a deeper level, where the reality of what we'd been working on was no longer a project, but actually just something that, you know, all that passion and time had been invested in was something now that I could actually live in the moment.
Is there a place on these 22 acres where you go that you feel is more special than others, or a go-to place where you just, you can think, you can reflect?
That certainly is intended to happen for everyone pretty much anywhere here. There are focal points, obviously. For me personally, there's a couple places that come to heart, not so much to mind. And let me just for a second say, I think this episode today of your show should be more properly called, instead of smart talk, should be called heart talk, because that's what I'm feeling. And when you ask me that question, the places where my heart is at peace are just down from that boulder at the crash site that I had the honor to be here the day that it was moved and put in place. There's a small spot there that has special significance for our family. And then perhaps the only other place is nearby, where there are some cabins back in the woods that, you know, folks who lived here long before Flight 93 crashed had built from, you know, their own hands. And it gives me a sense of connection over time of this place and sense of place. Those are two places where I really feel very connected, grounded, at home. But there are plenty of places around the entire 2,200 acres that I feel that way. Mm-hmm. And having been the person who helped the families purchase, you know, the vast majority of those acres, and then in turn participate in the process to sell them to the National Park Service, the federal government, I really feel a connection to all of the lands.
You know, we've been talking mostly about the last 20 years and a lot of memories and things that have occurred over the past 20 years. But unfortunately, we have to come back to today. A number of families have been upset with the federal government, thinking that there is more information that the federal government has that should be released to the families. In fact, some have gone as far as saying that they would prefer that President Biden not participate in September 11th activities or events until that information is released. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, certainly President Biden's not the first who has been asked for that information to be released. My understanding is he's agreed to review it and to see what may be eligible at this point in time to be released. Privilege wouldn't apply to. As a lawyer, I kind of understand that. I also look back to the Warren Commission. I was alive the day President Kennedy was shot, and understood that it took a long time to get to a place where some of that information was actually able to be understood with the passage of time as an historical event. I've also been down to Guantanamo Bay, along with my cousin Ken and other family members, and seen five of the individuals who were responsible for those actions that led to those almost 3,000 deaths on September 11th. And my understanding is that there's an interplay between some of the way that those cases may be resolved in the legal proceedings that could assist in information coming to light that the family members have sought. I respect their desire to have that information provided. I don't know what it is, obviously, but I believe that it is the responsibility of our elected officials to be present, to remember and honor all of those we lost at each of the three sites. And so I respect, as I said, their position, and we'll just have to, as time passes, see where the rest of that goes in terms of a legal proceeding.
I'm curious, the emotions that you and Ken had going to Guantanamo and seeing five of the people that were responsible for this.
You're about 45 seconds time delayed from the actual proceedings. You're looking through glass, plexiglass. So you have this surreal sense of watching something that's actually going on. But as a lawyer and understanding the legal process of, quote, litigation and criminal prosecutions, there's a lot of minutia, a lot of detail, a lot of process. But we had a chance to talk with the defense lawyers themselves in a separate meeting. They wanted to meet with the family members, and we did agree. And I can assure you that I impressed upon them that if the opportunity arose, notwithstanding whatever moral or other kinds of religious viewpoints I had come during that trip to a very clear place where if the death penalty were what was determined, that I would be willing to volunteer to be the one to actualize that for each and every one of their clients. And they understood eye to eye, heart to heart, mouth to ear. And I'm hopeful they communicated that to their clients, that there's a debt that's owed. And although there are multi-generational conflicts around what is at the core of what happened from the perspective of the terrorists, there's a peace, I believe, that can be achieved in finding a balance in the biblical eye for an eye. And so the feelings we had were quite a gamut. There was the cohesion of meeting other family members. A fellow who lost his mom came all the way from Australia. Detective out of New York lost, you know, his dad. Woman who similarly lost her family member in the trade centers. And so there was a sense of expanding what I call the Flight 93 family to what I call the September 11th family, purposefully avoiding use of 9/11, having been a former volunteer firefighter, EMS. 9/11 has some different meaning to me akin to 911. If there was an emergency that day, I'm proud that my cousin and others stood up and answered the call. But for me to honor their legacy, September 11th is the way that I mark it as a special day.
Patrick White, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, sharing your feelings and all the work that you've done for the families, for Americans, for the world, in putting this memorial together. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome, and thank you for allowing us the opportunity to share it with your audience.
And when, you know, the plane had to have gone down right after, well, when Phil was talking to Sandy, because she told him that she had to go because they were all running to the front. So, you know, it had to have gone down right after that.
Another one of the oral histories that you can hear by going online and going to the Flight 93 website, Memorial website, and hear so many people who have told their stories, and they are so compelling. I mean, we've heard some today, but you can hear from so many of the family members there in the oral histories. As we mark the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, you know, there's an entire generation of Americans that were either too young or weren't born yet to remember or understand the scope of what happened here and in New York and in Washington. We're joined by one of those people today, Kyle Kirchick. Kyle is from St. Michael, Pennsylvania. He's a student at Pennsylvania Highlands Community College. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And just to let you know, we are broadcasting from the Flight 93 Memorial, right outside of Shanksville, Pennsylvania, 20 years after the 9/11 attacks and Flight 93 crashing here. Kyle, how old were you on September 11th, 2001?
I was 5 years old, and I was in kindergarten.
You were in kindergarten at that time. Do you remember the day?
I do.
What do you remember about it?
I remember it was just any other regular day going to kindergarten. We weren't there that long that I can't remember. I'm pretty sure they didn't tell us what happened. I don't remember them telling us. I just remember being in class and the overhead come on and said that we were being dismissed early, and everyone was excited because we didn't know what was happening. We were like, oh, we get to go home early. I remember leaving and going outside thinking to get on the bus, and there my mom was in her car and my sister was with me, and she got us in the car. I could tell something was wrong. She wasn't acting right. She was like flustered and nervous. And we get home and my dad's sitting watching the TV. We go in the living room with them. And then my mom says she has to go to the hospital. She was a nurse at the time at Conemaugh in Johnstown, and she had to go to the hospital because in case anyone was flown there that needed help, they could be there. They never got anyone, but she had to go. But I remember sitting in the living room with my sister and my dad, and we were just watching TV and just seeing the towers. I still didn't know what was happening, but I remember seeing the towers burning and the people hanging outside of the tower. And I think I saw some of them fall on TV. It was a lot for me at that age. I know it was probably for like a lot of other people too, but.
Did you realize or did you learn that something had happened near you in St. Michael's? St. Michael's about a half hour away. Did you realize that something had happened nearby?
No, I didn't. I didn't know until I think maybe a couple of days later, I think we learned about it. And I remember we came here whenever they had the gate up for the makeshift memorial and being here with my parents. And this is my first time being back since then. Mm. So it's been 20 years since I've been here. And I remember the silence being here. It was, I've never heard silence that quiet.
So over the years, it has been 20 years. Mm-hmm. How was Flight 93 and 9/11 taught in school? What did you learn about it through those 20 years?
I would say through elementary school, we really didn't learn anything. It just every year when it would come to 9/11, we would have a day where we would remember what happened and have a moment of silence. It didn't take till maybe middle school for them to start telling us about it. Because I remember in middle school, the day Osama bin Laden was killed, I remember going into my history class and history teachers telling us how this is a big day and showing us all this stuff that's happening and the information. It wasn't until like probably then where they really started to like tell us what happened. Mm.
Do you feel any kind of sense of, I don't know, that kinship or something because you were so close to it? Your mother obviously having to go to work that day because they thought that there was a possibility of bringing some people to the hospital. Any feelings that something that you're a little bit closer to it?
Yeah. Yeah. Every year when this day comes around, I always remember that day in kindergarten, and every year I just remember everything that's happened. And
isn't it hard to believe it's been 20 years?
It is. It really is. And when I was telling my mom about this, that I was going to come here and do this, she even told me, remember, that's the first time you're going back there since then. And I was just like, I can't believe it's been 20 years.
Yeah. And it's a lot different than when you were here the first time.
Oh, yeah.
So Kyle Kirchick is from St. Michael's, Pennsylvania. He's a student at Pennsylvania Highlands Community College. Kyle, thanks for being with us and sharing your story of the past 20 years and what happened when you were in kindergarten. A lot of people don't remember things from kindergarten, but you know, this is one of those days, I'm sure, that 9/11 was a day that you always remember. So thank you very much for being with us
today. Thank you.
We've been broadcasting from the Flight 93 Memorial in Somerset County. The 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks coming up on Saturday. And we will have a whole lot more programming on Smart Talk and on WITF over the next few days marking that anniversary. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.